Okay.
Sorry, a bit of a belated start to the recording of our final review session for the last day of our statutory interpretation class. So we're going to do very quickly three things. One, I'm going to walk through the format, structure, grading, and things to know about the exam itself. Number two, I'm going to go through the multiple choice sample questions, which I will then explain the answers to. I can't remember if I actually posted an answer key onto the website that explains the rationale, so hopefully that will help. And then last, we'll go through the sample essay, and then after that, it's open season for as much time as we have. So, go ahead.
So, you're going to explain these, which means that like we're going to have the answer now, but we're going to think it later.
I'm sorry for that.
So, you're actually going to walk through the answer to all of this with my gear right now. So, like, this isn't for us to like take that home later.
Oh, no. I'm assuming you guys are way past taking practice tests at this point. You're already so long with statutory interpretation that this is just a quick confirmation to build your confidence. If you want to, please do. But that what I've handed out is basically an issue spotter, but it's not a sample answer. So feel free to do it the way you'd like to. So with that in mind, here's what you already know. This final exam is going to have three parts. It is designed to be given over the course of 3 hours. The three parts are all weighted equally. There will be one multiple choice section. There will be 20 questions. So you will have around 2 to 3 minutes per question. Hopefully that's a comfortable pace for those of you who already know it. It still gives you some wiggle room if you have one you need to look up on the fly. Now, I will have a Scantron sheet that will accompany the exam so you can just bubble it in and we won't have to worry about me cross-comparing your answer in your booklet with what you wrote to your hard copy exam. The Scantron will be the place to put it. It will only be multiple choice, no short answers. As much fun as I have with those, I think we need the clarity to be able to give you some choices that you can put A, B, C, or D. The essay questions are each also designed to be of equal length. I think you already have had a flavor of that from the midterm. I've talked with many of you already one-on-one, and I hope to get the rest of you on Monday. But the thing that I keep being asked repeatedly, and I'll make sure everyone's on the same page, is roughly what can you expect in the essay questions? And my answer is always, well, I can't tell you what's on the final exam. Having said that, imagine you're me. You're sitting and you're trying to write an exam that's fair to you. You guys have done a hell of a lot of work over the semester. I want to make sure you get a chance to show me. So I am likely to write an essay question that's broader rather than deeper. I'm not the guy who's going to ask you to go into a deep dive on a narrow issue to show me the complexity of your knowledge. I want to see how you'd be in the field in real life if the client walks into your office. You've got to give them a sense of what's important in their case. Number two, I'm going to most likely couch in terms of you being a lawyer, giving practical advice in a real world situation. I shouldn't say this, I hate to discount anything because I don't want to tell you something final, but I will say it's not in my DNA to ask you a theoretical or philosophical question. I'm very much going to want you to put yourself into the shoes of being the practicing lawyers you're going to be. That leads inevitably to two things. I'm going to be asking you a broad question that will reward spotting issues and give me discussions of those issues. The answer that does 80% on 5 or 6 issues will do much better than the one who does a beautiful deep dive on 2. So try and throw your scope of inquiry a little more broadly. If you have an issue that you think is relevant, even if it doesn't answer the case, like for example, if it involves a constitutional avoidance issue but you think it doesn't win, mention it so I can see you know it and explain to me why it doesn't win. The fact that it doesn't affect the outcome of the case doesn't mean it's not important to discuss. So last, I said two things. The second thing is it's going to be really hard for you as a professor to write a question that mixes everything together for the whole semester and then ask another question that mixes everything together for the whole semester and end up not duplicating. So there's always by necessity a rough categorization of the questions. One will tend to focus on statutory interpretation and legislative process, and one will tend to focus on administrative process. There might be some bleeding over between the two, but by and large, they tend to tackle different things. So I'll pause there. Any questions about just sort of the structure, the skeleton of the final exam? Yes?
So the midterm that we took, if our grade was higher, is going to replace one of those
Yeah, I'll get to grading in just a second. I promise you. I know that's something I want to make sure we can throw up. Okay, so in terms of structure or what to expect in the exam, any questions about that? Mechanics of the exam. I'm sure you guys are all now up to speed in the fact that blue books are now a historical artifact. You can take the exam and upload it directly into the cloud. If you want to handwrite your exam, that's totally fine, but you've got to give prior notice. We have to set up a special situation so that I don't know who's handwriting their exam, because otherwise I'll know who is taking it and who I'm grading. Because the numbers of people who handwrite exams has become so small, it's basically a fingerprint. If I have only two people handwriting exam, I'm likely going to know who those two people are when I grade it if they tell me they're handwriting. So we have procedures if you want to do that. Other than that, I will not bring dictionaries into the classroom. If there's any definitions, they'll be in the question. I'm going to be happy if you want to use the materials that you have generated or materials that are on the website that I've posted. So like if there's a flow chart, you're happy to print it out. You can use that. I am not, however, going to allow the use of third-party materials, especially commercial materials. I want to make sure that everyone has a level playing field in that respect. Some of those materials I know are either hard to find or expensive to buy, and I just want everyone to be in the same place in that respect. Beyond that, hopefully that's no surprises to anybody. It's straight up honor code. So I think I usually have a statement in there saying, yes, check, I'm being honorable. I think if you've gotten this far, I'm assuming all of you are honorable souls. So any questions about mechanics? Okay. Grading. In particular, I've already mentioned that all three sections will be weighted equally. Of the two essay exams, there is the option for those of you, I've had the default to tell them if you don't want this. If your grade is higher in the midterm, it can swap out for your lower exam questions. That is going to be based on letter grades, not your actual raw score. So if you got a high A or low A, congratulations, you just got an A. And that value will be plugged into whether or not it's higher than the letter grade in your final exam for that essay question. Now, that's because the numbers I use are arbitrary. I have it set up so that you may have 45 questions for one, points for one question, you may have 180 for another. All I care about is that the curve breaks out in a way that's fair to everybody. And I can talk about the curve and the school requirements for that if you're interested. So here's the key thing, and this is the part I really want to stress, because I've had several students pull me aside and very concerned about it. If you did great on the midterm, I heartily commend you and congratulations. I hope it lets you sleep better this weekend, and you earned it. And I'm not going to change the rules at this point, but do not take the colossal gamble of taking your foot off the pedal for one of the essay questions, or even just not answering. You're putting yourself at grave risk on two grounds. One, you're going to assume you get that second question you answer at the expense of the third perfectly. If you miss anything, kind of magnify the risk of the cost. But second, I gotta be honest with you, I'm a human being. If I give an exam, and it's quite clear someone has written 30 pages on one question and one on the last one, or a blank page, I'm going to assume that you took 2 hours to write an essay, and I'm going to read it more closely in light of that and put that kind of extra time and attention to it. So my strong presumption, my strong recommendation, the way I'm writing this exam, is everyone's going to give their best honest effort on all three parts, even if you did well in the midterm. So, like I said, if you choose to do so, I bless your risk-taking soul. But I strongly urge everyone not to do that. No. The multiple choice are just so incommensurate, I didn't throw it down the screen. Okay. Any others? I didn't mean to sound like everyone's grumpy grandfather, but I want to make sure that no one felt worried or jeopardized by that. Okay. So with that, I can also say I think our pizza's at the curb, so hopefully Joseph will come in with it. What I'd like to do is keep talking as it arrives. You guys are welcome to come up here and grab the slices and keep going. But how about this? I can go through the sample multiple choices, and I can go through the sample essay, or I can field questions. I'm happy to go wherever the spirit of the class dictates, where you feel like your needs are raised.
I would like to vote for the essay.
The essay? Okay. Anyone else? Consensus achieved? It's a one vote majority. Nicely worked. Nice work. Actually, having said that, I'm worried that the essay is going to soak up the time. So let me do a very brief walk through the multiple choices, and then I promise we're going to get right to the essay. Because here's the reason why. I had a lot of people who were very concerned about the multiple choices because they didn't get those back, so they haven't had a chance to see any feedback on them. So this will hopefully shed a little light as to how they work. And the idea here is a quick run through. If you guys have debates or issues you want to pick with me in terms of the choices, come see me afterwards. I'm glad to talk about it. But for here, this is just sort of to give you a kind of test run. So here are the quick questions. Number one, this is meant to highlight the fact that the multiple choice questions can involve some legislative process questions from the first third of the semester. It's easy to forget it because it's way in the past. But here, hopefully this is all fairly straightforward. Which of the following mitigates typically result in the death of any legislation? A, failure by the Senate Majority Leader to refer the bill to the committee. B, the Senate fails to approve a motion to invoke cloture against an announced filibuster by a single senator. C, a majority of the committee has received the bill but fails to report it back to the House or Senate. B or C or all of the above. It is so tempting to ask everyone to raise their hands and have entertaining discussions, but how about this? I'll just quickly walk through the answers and we can delve into more detail if you'd like, because I want to keep my promise to Mike to do this fast. The answer here, A, the parliamentarian in the Senate refers bills, not the Senate Majority Leader. B, it doesn't matter if it's a single senator or not. If they fail to invoke cloture, the bill ain't going anywhere. C, yes, in both the House and the Senate, the majority of the committee with jurisdiction fails to refer it. There, the bill languishes and typically dies. So the answer should be B and C. Number two, hopefully, is just the slam dunk easy gimme, nostrum associus. Basically, A, a tool to clarify the meaning of a broad catch-all term at the end of a list. B, a maxim that draws on the common or shared aspects of other words to identify the unclear term. C, Latin for a thing is known by its companions. D, B, or C. B and C, excuse me. And E, all of the above. Hopefully this one, you guys sort of like, it's almost like your hand writes it from muscle memory. Is it A? No, that's a justum. Is it B? Yes, that's the definition. Is it C? For sure, that's the Latin. Associus, social, easy. Answers B and C. Next up, the decision principle announced by Gregory V. Ashcroft. Federal presumption, federal clear statement rule, presumption against retroactivity, A and C, or all the above? Well, there is no presumption of retroactivity in that decision. So, that makes it easy to answer the rest, doesn't it? A small pointer, there are judges who will actually have the bailiff escort you out of the courtroom and put you in contempt for that. I won't, but just word of warning. So, actually, there are some judges that actually take your phones as you check in, and they lock it in the lockbox where you can go into the courtroom. It's pretty cool. So, I'm sorry, I'm totally off track now. Decision principle, Gregory V. Ashcroft. Well, it's not retroactivity, which means C ain't the answer. It means that D, A, and C are not the answer. So it's really between A and B, isn't it? And between the federalism presumption and the federalism clear statement rule, it's pretty clear B's the better answer. That's the phrase that the case is famous for. Drew? B and C. I'm sorry?
Well, on number one, on A, I know it's not the Senate Majority Leader, but I don't think it's the parliamentarian either. I thought it was the presiding officer, like what he advised of the parliamentarian, but it's the presiding officer who does the referral.
I think that's true, but the book actually says the parliamentarian is the one who takes care of the assignment. So I think you're right technically, but I'm going to go with what the book says just because that's fair to everybody else.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Questions? Any other questions in regards to 1 through 3? Let's get the last two out of the way fast. All right. Number 4. Which judicial action best demonstrates Scrivener's error? A. Congress erroneously overlooked an administrative interpretation when reauthorized the statute and therefore did not mean to accept that interpretation by reference. B, Congress rules that the wrong year was used. That's my turn. See, I'd be held in contempt. Tracy Hester. Yes. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. My teaching assistant is probably waiting for you at the parking lot. So hold on 1 second. Is there anyone here who's willing to volunteer to go? Go for it. I'm going to have somebody coming down to get the pizzas from you. You can hear he's getting applauded, so he's very popular right now. He says he's at the door to the commons.
Door to the commons.
So where exactly do you mean by door to the commons?
Right,
because
I know doors to
service. Hey, don't get lost. The side of the building closest to the freeway.
How about this? Hold on 1 second. I'm going to actually get my phone. This is not the side.
Oh, hopefully he's not going to call Mongolia with my phone. Okay. So, Scrivener's error. I was up to B. Did they make a mistake in saying 2013 rather than 2015? C, a court holds that Congress did not intend to include claims on December 31st to be included if the period, if the statute says prior to 31st. Now, B and C are all the above. Okay, once again, pick the easy killings, the easy the ones to strike out. It ain't C. That's U.S. v. Locke. That's Justice Marshall's opinion that said basically, too bad, so said, every deadline's inherently arbitrary, no Scrivener's error here. So that also means D is wrong. B and C can't apply. So your real choices are between A and B. A, mistakenly failing to include an administrative interpretation as opposed to the wrong date, it's clearly B. That's a kind of typographical error that Scrivener's error is meant to include. Scrivener's error is not meant to include the more subjective judgment calls that Congress allegedly may have mistakenly done, but it's not reflected in something that's just black and white. Scrivener's error is usually very narrowly applied. All clear so far?
Do you want me to go find Joseph and tell him to come back?
And if you feel comfortable missing the last question, I'm going to talk with you separately if you'd like. Okay, yeah, if you could, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
I just wanted to stay at the park club.
I feel bad I didn't think of that. I feel terrible.
Is he in the front of the school?
Yeah, he should be at the parking lot by the statue of Magnus. All right, the last one. I'm sure this is totally hypothetical. It would never, ever happen. But allegedly, there is rampant use of off-label use of prescription drugs for cognitive enhancement. Students are taking Adderall. They're taking Modafinil and Adderall. So the U.S. government has decided they ain't going to allow that anymore. And they're going to say that if you submit a test sample that shows the presence of these drugs, you don't get any kind of federal student financial aid. Kaboom. So one student gave a hair. The hair was long. As you may know, because the residuals in hair are key to how long the hair is, you can have drug samples showing you were exposed to a drug or took a drug going back years. This sample shows that she, or somehow, we don't know why or what situation, but that she had used or been exposed to one of these drugs before the statute was passed. So, which of these statutory canons are most likely going to be applied by a federal court? A, it doesn't apply because of rule of lenity. B, it doesn't apply because of presumption against retroactivity. C, it doesn't apply because a remedial purpose canon overrules presumption against retroactivity. And of course, my favorite pickups, D is A and C, or E, all of the above. I'm sorry?
No.
Why?
No, I'm saying you read E wrong.
Oh, I was about to say, I'm surprised you said that. None of the above, sorry about that. Okay, very quickly going through this. Awesome! There should be three pizzas of chicken tikka, three pizzas. Actually, we do have plates. Do you know my sister, Anna?
Yep.
If you go down, she should have a stack of plates for everybody in Evans. No, you should be thanking Hunter. I can't believe he's doing this for us. Okay, so with that in mind, question number five. If it's, is it A, rule of lenity? Easy. It's not criminal. Rule of lenity only applies to criminal statutes. This is just the denial of financial aid. It may feel like punishment. It may look and smell like punishment. There are some very rare cases where a civil assessment counts against the rule of lenity, but by and large, it is almost always a criminal statute. So A is off the table. That means Shazam, D is off the table. I'm using Shazam a lot today. I'm sorry about that. So that leaves us with B and C. B, the presumption against retroactivity, I think pretty clearly applies here, doesn't it? The question itself says that the rule, that the statute here was passed after she would have been conducted, been exposed to or taken the drug. So that leaves the question of C. The remedial purpose canon overrides presumption of retroactivity. Remember the remedial purpose canon I mentioned? It's kind of was an earlier statutory construction principle that is now disfavored by the federal courts. Any statute by presumption has a remedial purpose. So therefore, you don't liberally construe and give it extra power just because it's remedial. So B is the better answer. So the answer is B. So hopefully those, you know, with the exception of maybe arguing on question number one, thanks to Huey's point, most of these are fairly straightforward, and I tried to ask them so that there's not a whole lot of agonizing. They should have fairly clear answers. So any concerns, questions, comments? Yes?
So is this like reflective of the kind of question on the exam, or are these like easier or harder?
I think they're about that, maybe slightly easier, because just frankly, with 20 questions, I don't want to brutalize you. But that's about the right zone. They certainly aren't going to be significantly harder. Any other questions?
So you said that you get letter grades for the essay. Is that the multiple choice too?
No. Multiple choice is just straight up, right or wrong, then you get points per question.
So like the total points would be letter grade?
Well, actually, that's a good question, because usually I just put the whole number of points together into it. But I'll probably have to do as a letter grade just because that's another whole system things together. So you know, if you get an A, it'll be curved in the multiple choice. I'm sorry. Awesome.
I don't know if you already remember this, but the multiple choice, it's technically a third of the exam, but is it weighted to be a third of the exam?
The multiple choice is a third, it's the third of the points of the exam. Okay. It should be a third of your time as well. Is that what you're asking? Any others? All right. So any other questions about multiple choice? Because I'll make sure we have time for the sample essay very briefly. Okay. Looking around. So all set?
I found somebody else who knows him to text him. I couldn't find him.
That's worrisome. Sort of like a law school version of Taken. Who knows where it is right now?
I do not have a set of skills.
Kyra, you had your hand up. Were you going to say?
No, I think
I have. Okay, great. All right. Anything else? All right. Then, has everyone had a chance to at least glance at the essay question? You'd like to have a minute or two? Maybe come and grab slices of pizza while that happens, or? Well, the plates may come in a second here. How about this? Start grabbing pizza. I'm going to go get the plates, help Hunter bring them up.
Right.
This is what? He said one of them is chicken tiki and spinach and
I'm going to go to the next one.
after enough plates, so between plates and napkins, we should be all set. Is Hunter back?
No, he's not. You're...
Can someone text him for me?
I'll text him.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
I didn't see him.
What's the green one?
The green one is mater paneer. It's veggie. That helps.
I guess my question about the grading, I think, was say you get 15 right, and then that's a B, and say like 16 would be a B plus, and then like say a 13 would be a B minus, like how would that?
What will happen is they'll end up compressing so that if there are like 5 people with B minuses, they'll all end up to the same numerical scores or something.
Oh, the score will be this, okay. It's still points, it's just half. Okay. It's not curved like the essays are.
Right.
That's okay. I was just concerned saying like there could be something like this one question.
I don't think that's
okay, okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Sure. All right. Sorry, but please grab it. I'm sorry. Thank you so much. I'm sorry.
Of course.
I just have this.
That's good.
No.
Okay, did everyone get a piece of pizza who wanted one? Did anyone get shorted? You sure can? Okay. No, the reason I'm saying is I'm also I'm breaking bread with my 1 o'clock class. So if you're up for silly place, but it's fun. It's called Cowboys and Indians. It's a Texan Indian restaurant. So they'll have, for example, Indian empanadas. It's kind of interesting. So if you'd like some, they'll have a little bit extra stuff on.
That
can
be fantastic.
All right. So the essay question. The essay question is about taking animals back from extinction. This is a real project. It's not Jurassic Park, I heard that. It's called the Lazarus Project. They've actually brought some species theoretically extinct back into existence. Including the gastric brooding frog, their efforts to bring back the carrier pigeon in the Australian Thylacine. So this is not science fiction. It's actually something that we've actually been doing some research on. So having said that, the question here is the federal government has decided that no matter how much pain and suffering the individual test animals go through, the benefit of bringing the entire species back from death outweighs it. And that effectively under animal welfare statutes, they're going to make the interpretation that they're going to allow individual animals to be bred and created even if they have a short lifespan or advanced crippling degenerative diseases or other types of painful impairments. So once again, notice the format here. I am asking you guys to represent a client who has walked into your office. They want to challenge that ruling because they think it is a violation of the Animal Cruelty Prevention Act. So your challenge, since this is a question focused on the promulgation of an agency interpretation of a federal statute, the Animal Cruelty Prevention Act, what sort of metric do you run it through? What challenges offer you the best opportunity? So to answer that, I am torn between a desire to lapse into classroom mode and have you guys help me map it out together, collectively and jointly. in the interest of efficiency and time, what I may suggest is let me walk through the sample metric I have, and you guys can tell me if it, you have questions about it or if you have alternative ways to tackle it and want to benchmark with me. So with that in mind, what it really goes into is this sort of thing I always do, which is, one, can you challenge it in court? Does the APA give you a right? Second, procedurally, is it defective? And third, substantively, can you challenge it, which is really a Chevron issue in this case. Here, the problem is it's a proposed rule. It's not a final rule. Remember, under the APA, you can only bring a judicial challenge to final agency action. So your first challenge is going to be finding some way to get around that initial barrier. Number two, even if it is a final agency action, is the supporting memorandum itself explaining the agency's rationale part of the justification available to it under the record? Can you count it? Or is it exempt as an interpretive statement or as a matter of general policy statement? I'm not saying that I have an answer for you in all these. I'm identifying these as issues you would have to discuss, Jeff.
Can you talk a second about what's required for interpretive rules under the APA? Talk about that there's a carve out for it, mm-hmm. so it's not subject to like formal stuff.
A standalone interpretive rule is exempt from APA requirements for publication in the Federal Register. It also is subject from other certain procedural requirements. But by and large, if an interpretive rule is baked into a rule that requires substantive action, such as in this one, typically it's included as part of the overall review under the APA for arbitrary and capricious. So,
could you give an example of a standalone interpretive rule that doesn't require subsequent action?
Frankly, at one point, of course we have this semester. I can give you some real life ones.
Sure, just anything to like distinguish from all
of it. EPA General Counsel memorandum saying that carbon dioxide is not included in the term air act. Standalone.
Does that not require subsequent action because you have to regulate it differently?
No. Basically, it was an internal memorandum saying that since it wasn't approved, they didn't have to pass any regulations. It never got published, it never got into the register. It's an internal EPA General Counsel memorandum.
Oh, so it had implications about not taking future action.
If it shows up in a future, exactly. So if it showed up in a future rulemaking, at that point it's fair game. But okay. You can't sue over that memorandum itself. Okay? The other part of all this, besides final agency action and determining whether or not it falls within the purview for review under the APA, in a way this is enforcement action, isn't it? The federal agency involved here is basically saying we're not going to prosecute anybody under the Animal Cruelty Prevention Act if you bring an animal species back from extinction. It's stated wrongly, but it boils down to individual cases of not prosecuted, not enforcing. That's a Heckler v. Cheney issue. Again, you can tell me where you fall on that. I'm not saying there's a right or wrong answer. I do think there is a right or wrong answer, but nonetheless, what I want you to do is to spot it, cogently discuss it, figure out how it gives you the answer to your client. So, and if you get past those, then you sort of get to the questions about were there comments submitted in a notice of comment period that would give you a basis to sue on, or to relate to the record, and then you start getting to the State Farm procedural review of whether or not you satisfy the requirements. So, taking a pause, does that all hang together for everyone so far? Because I guarantee you, these are the sort of issues that pop up on any administrative agency question. It's just inevitable. So I'll try and write something that's an interesting topic. I think it is interesting. But at the same time, by necessity and fairness, it will tend to raise similar issues. Yes?
So Heckler v. Cheney says that inaction is the presumption of, against judicial review of inaction.
Right? Judicial review of in a decision not to enforce. There is a presumption of unreviewability for enforcement discretion.
Then how
does
that differ from
mass procedure? Bless you. Because the decision there was, it wasn't just agency in action. There was an actual petition for review submitted to the agency saying, we want this rule. Another sneeze, I missed it. The agency said, go away, you bother me. That was an affirmative agency action that was subject to review. In a sense, the petition was very clever. It flipped an agency inaction to a positive act that was subject to judicial review. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay. That's why Barbara lawyers love Mass EPA so much. It's just, it has all sorts of interesting tools built into it. Okay, so we've gotten through that initial threshold determination. I'm sorry, I was rolling ahead there.
So under E, does the person have that stand-in, or can anyone sue for the arbitrary versus standard?
Well, with the caveat, we didn't talk about this in class. So I'm sharing this with you, and I'm hoping it would be an answer you'd already know from your other classes. But if it's in federal court, you still have to show Article III standing. So you have to show that in some way the agency rule creates some type of either cognizable injury to a concrete interest or an injury in fact to you. You can't just sue because you dislike it philosophically. Now, the nature of the injury could be very minor. It could be a procedural injury. But bottom line, typically, you've got to still meet Article III standards. Congress can't wave them away. Okay. Great question, Drew.
But there won't be any points for talking about standing on this event, right?
I will be impressed. I will think warmly of you when you graduate. But I can't give you points for it. It's not something we've covered in class.
Right.
All right. Any others? Okay. So now we get to what we talked about the past couple of days. Assuming you've jumped through the APA prerequisites and thresholds, and you've gone through the State Farm turning of the crank on whether or not it met procedural requirements and is not arbitrary and capricious on those grounds. The next question is whether or not you have a standard of review of the statute that's been brought by the agency. And here, of course, it's Meade, Chevron, Skidmore. The Meade test here is what we're dealing with is an interpretive memorandum. Can that qualify for Meade to be the exercise of the kind of power conferred to the federal agency in a way that Congress gave it to them and that they properly exercised it, that they actually exercised it? So, you know, here, I have to say, I probably should have moved A2, the explicit delegation to the agency. That's actually really that's a Chevron question. It's not under me. Sorry about that. So, apparently no explicit delegation was given to the agency to make the interpretation on this issue, so the USDA does not get arbitrary and capricious review. Remember, that's actually Chevron. So bump that one down one order here. Sorry if that misleads anybody. Let's assume we decide under B, Chevron does apply. Is it step one review or step two? Here, does the statute speak to the direct issue unambiguously? I don't give you a lot to work with here. You have a little bit of statutory language. So I'd expect you to say, given the interpreted statutory language, here are the things we have to look for to determine whether or not it meets the requirements. It's a standard statutory interpretation stuff that you would have already covered early this semester or in the other question, presumably. So, you know, I'd leave to you at this point a little undefined what sort of tools you'd pick up. But the key thing here is I'd want you to say you use the standard tools of statutory interpretation. That gets to step two. And was it reasonable? And here, the sorts of things you'd look to are whether it's a very flexible standard, it's very deferential to the agency. The agency clearly has expertise and has rationale for justifying its interpretation. So, you know, again, I'm not going to tell you I have a right or wrong answer, but usually the agency's interpretation will prevail under the step two analysis in this kind of circumstance. Now, notice you, at some point, I leave it to you where you plug it in. It could be an important questions issue. There also could be a question about whether or not, I'm going to stop there because I want you to not overtax yourself in terms of including so many issues. In terms of the judicial pushback doctrines, your readings included some of those. For now, I'll be honest with you, when I write this, when I'm looking at the exam question answers, I'm not going to be looking as much for things that are in the book we didn't talk about in class. So I expect you to mention those. If you mention these other issues that are just in the reading, it's like additional icing on the cake, but it's not something that's going to make a big point difference. Having said that then, if it doesn't apply, we all know, Skidmore. And at that point, I expect you to invoke the four elements to the extent you see that they apply. And then last, of course, our. If this is an agency interpretive memorandum that focuses on its own regulations. So that's pretty much, I know it's a fast run, it's a lot of ground to cover, but it's a sort of approach that tends to be fairly flexible. It is the sort of thing you can see for most questions where an agency is taking an action that involves an interpretation of the statute. Then final point, we might mention, especially the question requested, what the likely remedy is going to be. And here, the vast majority of cases, the rule gets remanded back to the agency for a do-over. So here, USDA gets another crack at it. The other interesting subtext, all right, now, you don't want to hear interesting subtext here, sorry. I'll simply say this. If it remands to the agency, the rule remains in effect during the remand, typically, unless you get an injunction to stop it. So in a way, agencies don't mind losing these cases. Their rule's still in effect while they rethink it. That could take years. So you don't have to get that in box down. I just thought you'd like to know that. All right, so I feel like I've been auctioneering. Questions? And not only about this schematic, but also in general with the past few minutes we have left.
In what circumstances do you have? You only have to file comments in the lawsuit if it's formal rulemaking. If it's informal rulemaking, or if it's a guideline, or a flyer, or a circular, or anything else, or any other agency action, then there isn't a notice and comment process that has to be done before you bring suit.
Yes, almost. Informal rulemaking does have records. That's notice and comment rulemaking.
So for both types of rulemaking. For other agencies.
But if there's a guidance document, typically it just appears magically from the waves. There is no record supporting it. Now, there's a caveat there. The agency can choose, if it wants to publish a guidance in the Federal Register. They can invite comments on it. They aren't barred from doing it if they like. Sometimes they do if they think it kind of gives them cover. But the vast majority of cases, no. It's the guidance that doesn't get to go through that process. Sure. Okay. Sorry.
So in this, in the problem, it calls it a guidance and it says they went through a notice and comment, like a notice and comment period. Does that really make it a rule, or the fact that it defines rights make it a rule, or like defines rights? Is that the kind of argument you would make when you're talking about whether it's reviewable or not?
You've identified the issue. What's issue? This is going back to my response a few weeks ago. If they did notice and comment, will they come? It's still just a guidance. They can do that if they choose. The key thing is this. Is it a guidance or memorandum that's basically a rule in disguise? And we talked a little bit about that principle, that sometimes if an agency wants to do a stealth rule, the courts will call them on it, and what they look for is whether or not it actually substantially affects the rights of individuals, and does it look small that like a rule? It's small that.
In a statutory interpretation,
I
say, explanation of different jurisprudential interpretation, the theories like ritualism, textualism, that kind of thing. Do those have any play value, or is that just this? But
I want to give you a fair answer. And I think the real answer is it's meant to duplicate what you will do in real life. And I guarantee you, any judge you go to and you start talking about those philosophical doctrines, he or she may find it interesting, but it will not affect their decision in the case. So it won't hurt you in terms of points. It probably will hurt you since you miss out on the right stuff that matters.
Okay, so then I guess just a quick follow-up to that is, and you said, you'll write it from the perspective of a lawyer. Are we writing it as if the audience is the judge?
Depends on the question.
Okay.
I may ask you to write it to the general counsel of the company. I may ask you to write it to the NGO. I may actually write it simply because you're trying to develop a particular line of work. Usually I'll identify the client, but it's not always a judge. Okay. Right. Oh, sorry.
Does it matter if it's called an interpretive rule versus an interpretive statement?
The real world answer? No. So the answer for here? No. I'm sorry, I'm resisting the law professor to say, well, we could really go deep on that, but for now, no.
I'm sorry, is there a difference between a guidance that goes through notice and comment period and an informal rule that goes through notice and comment period?
Well, would it affect the thoroughness, validity, consistency, or power to persuade the guidance?
Well, because I feel like here, if Congress gave them the authority, if it just follows formal EPA stuff, so if they went through a notice and comment period, then they followed the procedure, but they didn't call it an informal rule, so maybe they didn't, and I don't
know. Yeah. Now, put it this way, it's certainly relevant for state law consideration. It's certainly relevant for B consideration. does Chevron apply to things that aren't necessarily rules?
Yes.
It can. So, it might. The real question there is whether the site called an interpretive guidance or Miranda, it's not a rule or not. That's a question that do the assessment just talk to the Miranda. Does that help?
Where it's so it's, even if it was a guidance that had the effect of rule of American mining, and it went to the normal procedures for a rule, it could be a Chevron.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I think I missed the answer to the first question. So the client can't bring legal action against the rule because it's not a final action. However, if it is, if it falls under the interpretive rule exemption or the statement of general policy, then they can bring an action. The client can bring action against this particular rule?
Not quite. You need to identify that it could be a final agency action or not. Why? How could this be a final agency action?
They because issued of the comment.
Right. They issued it, the contract is done, it's finished, and they're going to start taking actions as an agency from this moment. So you could argue it's effectively a final agency action. Then. It's effective rights.
And so the client can bring an action because of that.
I'm telling you, the government's saying, hell no, it's not a final agency action. So we pass a rule. This is just a memo. That I'm saying there's not, this is designed so there's not a clear answer.
So then when I'm answering it, I should say, there's not a clear answer to this question. You probably can't bring a rule or bring an action against this rule. However, if you were to do so, blah, 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 blah.
I'm not sure about the blah, 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 blah part.
I mean, you can clearly rule for us.
Short answer is, I'm going to ask you to come to the and ask you to give me the reasons for it, and also typically to point out the strongest and countervailing arguments. So I would expect you to say, as if you're giving advice to your client, who is the advocate for the athletes.
And so if I'm giving advice, I'm not like, no, you can't bring this.
I'd say,
don't do it.
I'd say, you're going to have a serious problem showing this is final. We can argue that maybe it is final standard because they've completed every action related to it. There's nothing further to do to it, and they're going to rely on it for future. That may make it a follow-up. However, if it doesn't pronounce a follow-up section, we can't sue. Nonetheless, if we can sue, here are some other things that will follow.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that counts as blah, 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 but it's close.
Okay.
All right, anything? Oh my gosh, my 1 o'clock is coming up. Seriously, any important last minute things you want to talk about? Yes, Mike. Well, I'll be in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. But how about this? I am available Monday, if anyone still needs to sign up. And before you all scatter, I promised I'd make a grand speaking statement, but since time has run short, this has been an amazingly fun class for me, as you can tell. It went by incredibly quickly. The most important thing I want to share with you is I'm hoping that as we move ahead, that we will not lose touch. It always grieves me that I have great first-year classes that I never see you for another 2 years. So even if you're not taking my classes, come by, stay in touch if I can help. I'm here. And other than that, good luck, Godspeed, and I'll see you next week.